Objection overruled. How many, Mr. Cogburn?
I never shot nobody. I didn't have to.
That was not the question. How many?
Shot or killed?
Let us restrict it to killed, so we may have a manageable figure. How many people have you killed since you became a marshal for this court?
Around 12 or 15, stopping men in flight and defending myself.
Around 12 or 15, so many that you cannot keep a precise count. Remember that you are under oath. I have examined the records, and a more accurate figure is readily available. Come now, how many?
I believe them two Whartons made 23.
I felt sure it would come to you with a little effort. Now let us see. 23 dead men in 4 years. That comes to about 6 men a year. It's dangerous work. So it would seem. And yet how much more dangerous for those luckless individuals who find themselves being arrested by you. How many members of this one family, the Horton family, have you killed? Your Honor, I think counsel should be advised that the marshal is not the defendant in this action. Your Honor, my client and his deceased father and brother were provoked into a gun battle by this man Cogburn. Last spring, he shot and killed Aaron Horton's oldest son, and on November 2nd, he fairly leapt at the chance to massacre the rest of the family. I will prove that. This assassin, Cogburn, has too long been clothed with the authority of an honorable court. The only way I can prove my client's innocence is by bringing out the facts of these two related shootings, together with a searching review of Cogburn's methods. All the other principals, including Marshal Potter, are conveniently dead.
That will do, Mr. Gowdy. Restrain yourself. We shall hear your argument later. The defense will be given every latitude. I do not think the indiscriminate use of such words as massacre and assassin will bring us any nearer the truth. Pray continue with your cross-examination.
Thank you, Your Honor. Mr. Cogburn, did you know the late Dub Horton, brother to the defendant Otis Horton?
I had to shoot him in self-defense last April in the Going Snake district of the Cherokee Nation.
How did that come about?
I was trying to serve a warrant on him for selling ardent spirits to the Cherokees. It was not the first one. He come at me with a king bolt and said, "Rooster, I'm going to punch that other eye out." I defended myself.
He was armed with nothing more than a king bolt from a wagon tongue?
I didn't know what else he had. I saw he had that. I have seen men badly tore up with things no bigger than a king bolt.
Were you yourself armed?
Yes, sir. Had a handgun.
What kind of handgun?
A .44-40 Colt's revolver.
Is it not true that you walked in upon him in the dead of night with that revolver in your hand and gave him no warning?
I had pulled it, yes, sir.
Was the weapon loaded and cocked?
Yes, sir.
Were you holding it behind you or in any way concealing it?
No, sir.
Are you saying that Dub Horton advanced into the muzzle of that cocked revolver with nothing more than a small piece of iron in his hand?
That was the way of it.
It is passing strange. Now, is it not true that on November 2nd, you appeared before Aaron Horton and his two sons in a similar menacing manner, which is to say, you sprang upon them from cover with that same deadly six-shot revolver in your hand?
I always try to be ready.
The gun was pulled and ready in your hand?
Yes, sir.
Loaded and cocked?
If it ain't loaded and cocked, it will not shoot.
Just answer my questions, if you please.
That one does not make any sense.
Do not bandy words with counsel, Mr. Cogburn.
Yes, sir.
Mr. Cogburn, I now direct your attention back to that scene on the creek bank. It is near dusk. Mr. Aaron Horton and his two surviving sons are going about their lawful business, secure on their own property. They are butchering a hog so that they might have a little meat for their table.
Them was stolen hogs. That farm belongs to the Horton squaw, Minnie Wharton.
Your Honor, will you instruct this witness to keep silent until he is asked a question?
Yes, and I will instruct you to start asking questions so that he may respond with answers.
I am sorry, Your Honor. All right.
Mr. Horton and his sons are on the creek bank. Suddenly, out of the break, spring two men with revolvers at the ready.
An objection. The objection has merit. Mr. Gowdy, I have been extremely indulgent. I am going to permit you to continue this line of questioning, but I must insist that the cross-examination take the form of questions and answers instead of dramatic soliloquies. And I will caution you that this had best lead to something substantial and fairly soon.
Thank you, Your Honor. If the court will bear with me for a time. My client has expressed fears about the severity of this court, but I have reassured him that no man in this noble republic loves truth and justice and mercy more than Judge Isaac Parker.
You are out of order, Mr. Gowdy.
Yes, sir. All right. Now, Mr. Cogburn, when you and Marshal Potter sprang from the brush, what was Aaron Wharton's reaction on seeing you?
He picked up an axe and commenced to cussing us.
An instinctive reflex against a sudden danger. Was that the nature of the move?
I don't know what that means.
You would not have made such a move yourself.
If it was me and Potter with the drop, I would have done what I was told.
Yes, exactly. You and Potter. We can agree that the Whartons were in peril of their lives.
All right. Let us go back to yet an earlier scene at the Spotted Gourd home, around the wagon. Who was in charge of that wagon?
Deputy Marshal Smith.
He did not want you to go to the Wharton place, did he?
We talked about it some, and he agreed Potter and me should go.
But at first, he did not want you to go, did he? Knowing that there was bad blood between you and the Whartons.
He must have wanted me to go, or he would not have sent me.
You had to persuade him, did you not?
I knowed the Whartons, and I was afraid somebody would get killed going up against them.
As it turned out, how many were killed?
3. But the Whartons did not get away. It could have been worse.
Yes, you might have been killed yourself.
You mistake my meaning. 3 murdering thieves might have got loose and gone to kill somebody else. But you are right that I might have been killed myself. It was mighty close at that, and it is no light matter to me.
Nor to me. You are truly one of nature's survivors, Mr. Cogburn, and I do not make light of your gift. I believe you testified that you backed away from Aaron Wharton.
That is right.
You were backing away?
Yes, sir. He had that axe raised.
Which direction were you going?
I always go backwards when I'm backing up.
I appreciate the humor of that remark. Aaron Wharton was standing by the washpot when you arrived?
It was more like squatting. He was stoking up the fire under the pot.
And where was the axe?
Right there at his hand.
Now, you say you had a cocked revolver clearly visible in your hand, and yet he picked up that axe and advanced upon you, somewhat in the manner of Dub Wharton, with that nail or rolled up paper or whatever it was in his hand.
Yes, sir. Commenced to cussing and laying about with threats.
And you were backing away. You were moving away from the direction of the washpot.
Yes, sir.
How far did you back up before the shooting started?
About 7 or 8 steps.
Meaning, Aaron Wharton advanced on you about the same distance, some 7 or 8 steps.
Something like that.
What would that be? About 16 feet?
Something like that.
Will you explain to the jury why his body was found immediately by the washpot with one arm in the fire, his sleeve and hand smoldering?
I don't think that is where he was.
Did you move the body after you had shot him?
No, sir.
You did not drag his body back to the fire?
No, sir. I don't think that is where he was.
Two witnesses who arrived on the scene moments after the shooting will testify to the location of the body. You don't remember moving the body.
If that is where he was, I might have moved him. I don't remember it.
Why did you place the upper part of his body in the fire?
Well, I didn't do it.
Then you did not move him, and he was not advancing upon you at all. Or you did move him and throw his body in the flames. Which? Make up your mind.
Them hogs that was rooting around there might have moved him.
Hogs, indeed. Mr. Gowdy, darkness is upon us. Do you think you can finish with this witness in the next few minutes?
I will need more time, Your Honor.
Very well. You may resume at 8:30 o'clock tomorrow morning. Mr. Cogburn, you will return to the witness stand at that time. The jury will not talk to others or converse amongst themselves about this case. The defendant is remanded to custody.
The judge rapped his gavel, and I jumped, not looking for that noise. The crowd broke up to leave. I had not been able to get a good look at that Otis Wharton, but now I did when he stood up with an officer on each side of him. Even though he had one arm in a sling, they kept his wrists cuffed in court. That was how dangerous he was. If there ever was a man with black murder in his countenance, it was Otis Wharton. He was a half-breed, with eyes that were mean and close-set, and that stayed open all the time like snake eyes. It was a face hardened in sin. Creeks are good Indians, they say, but a Creek white like him or a Creek Negro is something else again. When the officers were taking Wharton out, he passed by Rooster Cogburn and said something to him, some ugly insult or threat, you could tell. Rooster just looked at him. The people pushed me on through the door and outside. I waited on the porch. Rooster was one of the last ones out. He had a paper in one hand and a sack of tobacco in the other, and he was trying to roll a cigarette. His hands were shaking, and he was spilling tobacco. I approached him and said, "Mr. Rooster Cogburn?" He said, "What is it?" His mind was on something else. I said, "I would like to talk with you a minute." He looked me over. "What is it?" he said.
I said, "They tell me you are a man with true grit."
He said, "What do you want, girl? Speak up. It is supper time." I said, "Let me show you how to do that." I took the half-made cigarette and shaped it up and licked it and sealed it and twisted the ends and gave it back to him. It was pretty loose because he had already wrinkled the paper. He lit it, and it flamed up and burned about halfway down. I said, "Your makings are too dry." He studied it and said, "Something."
I said, "I am looking for the man who shot and killed my father, Frank Ross, in front of the Monarch boarding house. The man's name is Tom Cheney. They say he is over in the Indian Territory, and I need somebody to go after him."
He said, "What is your name, girl? Where do you live?"
"My name is Maddie Ross," I replied. "We are located in Yell County near Dardanelle. My mother is at home looking after my sister Victoria and my brother little Frank."
"You had best go home to them," said he. "They will need some help with the churning."
I said, "The high sheriff and a man in the marshal's office have given me the full particulars. You can get a fugitive warrant for Tom Cheney and go after him. The government will pay you $2 for bringing him in, plus 10 cents a mile for each of you. On top of that, I will pay you a $50 reward."
"You have looked into this a right smart," said he.
"Yes, I have," said I. "I mean business."
He said, "What have you got there in your poke?"
I opened the sugar sack and showed him.
"By God," said he, "a Colt's Dragoon. Why, you are no bigger than a corn nubbin. What are you doing with that pistol?"
I said, "It belonged to my father. I intend to kill Tom Cheney with it if the law fails to do so."
"Well, that piece'll do the job, if you can find a high stump to rest it on while you take aim and shoot."
"Nobody here knew my father, and I'm afraid nothing much is going to be done about Cheney except I do it myself. My brother is a child, and my mother's people are in Monterey, California. My grandfather Ross is not able to ride."
"I don't believe you have $50.
"I will have it in a day or two. Have you heard of a robber called Lucky Ned Pepper?"
"I know him well. I shot him in the lip last August down in the Winding Stair Mountains. He was plenty lucky that day.
They think Tom Chaney has tied up with him.
I don't believe you have $50, baby sister. But if you're hungry, I'll give you supper and we'll talk it over and make medicine. How does that suit you?
I said it suited me right down to the ground. I figured he would live in a house with his family and was not prepared to discover that he had only a small room in the back of a Chinese grocery store on a dark street. He didn't have a wife. The Chinaman was called Lee. He had a supper ready of boiled potatoes and stew meat. The three of us ate at a low table with a coal oil lamp in the middle of it. There was a blanket for a tablecloth. A little bell rang once, and Lee went up front through a curtain to wait on a customer. Rooster said he had heard about the shooting of my father, but did not know the details. I told him. I noticed by the lamplight that his bad left eye was not completely shut. A little crescent of white showed at the bottom and glistened in the light. He ate with a spoon in one hand and a wadded-up piece of white bread in the other, with considerable sopping. What a contrast to the Chinaman with his delicate chopsticks. I had never seen them in use before. Such nimble fingers. When the coffee had boiled, Lee got the pot off the stove and started to pour. I put my hand over my cup. I do not drink coffee, thank you.
Rooster said, "What do you drink?"
I am partial to cold buttermilk when I can get it.
Well, we don't have none, said he. No lemonade either.
Do you have any sweet milk? Lee went up front to his icebox and brought back a jar of milk. The cream had been skimmed from it. I said, "This tastes like Blue John to me." Rooster took my cup and put it on the floor, and a fat brindle cat appeared out of the darkness where the bunks were and came over to lap up the milk. Rooster said,
"The general is not so hard to please."
The cat's name was General Sterling Price. Lee served some honey cakes for dessert, and Rooster spread butter and preserves all over his like a small child. He had a sweet tooth. I offered to clean things up, and they took me at my word. The pump and the washstand were outside. The cat followed me out for the scraps. I did the best I could on the enamelware plates with a rag and yellow soap and cold water. When I got back inside, Rooster and Lee were playing cards on the table.
Rooster said, "Let me have my cup."
I gave it to him, and he poured some whiskey in it from a demijohn. Lee smoked a long pipe. I said, "What about my proposition?"
Rooster said, "I'm thinking on it."
"What is that you're playing?"
"Seven up. You want a hand?"
"I don't know how to play it. I know how to play bid whist."
"We don't play bid whist," I said.
"It sounds like a mighty easy way to make $50 to me. You would just be doing your job anyway and getting extra pay besides."
"Don't crowd me," said he. "I'm thinking about expenses."
I watched them and kept quiet, except for blowing my nose now and again. After a time, I said, "I don't see how you can play cards and drink whiskey and think about this detective business all at the same time." He said,
"If I'm going up against Ned Pepper, I'll need $100. I have figured out that much. I want $50 in advance."
"You're trying to take advantage of me."
"I'm giving you my children's rate," he said. "It will not be an easy job of work smoking Ned out. He will be holed up down there in the hills in the Choctaw Nation. There'll be expenses."
"I hope you don't think I'm going to keep you in whiskey."
"I don't have to buy that. I confiscate it. You might try a little touch of it for your cold."
"No, thank you."
"This is the real article. It is double rectified bust head from Madison County, aged in the keg. A little spoonful would do you a power of good."
I would not put a thief in my mouth to steal my brains.
"Oh, you wouldn't, would you?"
"No, I wouldn't."
"Well, $100 is my price, sis. There it is."
For that kind of money, I would want a guarantee.